Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? It is I, the former military officer, Ray Powell, in California. It is he, former diplomat, Jim Caruso, in... Where are you, Jim?
I'm in Tucson, Arizona. Look out my window, see the Rincon Mountains. Bright, clear, sunny day. It beats the hell out of being in the rainy Northeast, where Victor is.
Well, yes, Victor Chin, who represents Taiwan's Kuomintang Party in the United States. Now, the KMT, or Kuomintang, it was Taiwan's longtime ruling party. In fact, it was the only party under allowed until the political reforms of the 1980s. But that was from the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949, when Chiang Kai-shek and his followers fled to the island until really the year 2000, which was the first time that we saw a change in party in Taipei. Since then, it's competed with the Democratic People's Party for primacy. And in this year's elections, the KMT lost a third straight presidential race, though it did gain seats in Taiwan's parliament, though amid a strong third party movement that captured vote share from both major parties. Victor Chin, thank you for joining us. In the 2024 election, the KMT, though it did gain seats, only got about a third of the vote. So why should our viewers care about it?
Right. First of all, Ray and Jim, it's a pleasure to be on your podcast. You raised a very interesting question. Actually, after the January elections, within the party, we have a lot of reviews talking about what did we do wrong. But I would say that from the outset, that is, it takes more than one political party for a democracy to work. So although we didn't win the presidential elections as expected, but I still see the KMT as a very important political party in Taiwan that started the democratization reform and allowed opposition party to flourish, I would say, and also safeguarding the democratic institutions of Taiwan. So in that regard, I still think that we offer a very important contribution to the democratic development of Taiwan. And you just mentioned that we managed to become the largest party in the legislature. And in the past half a year or even 8 months, we have a very good working coalition with the Taiwan People's Party. So together, we form a majority, a workable majority in the legislature that can serve as a very important oversight power or check and balances over the executive branch, which is controlled by the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party. So in that regard, I think it also offers, our party also offers a very important role in this political development of Taiwan.
Well, you're in Washington, Victor, and I'm sure you see that Americans presume that the key political question in Taiwan is how to manage relations with mainland China and the CCP. Is that accurate?
That is increasingly the people's concern, especially in the past few years when the People's Liberation Army started this daily sort of sorties to surround Taiwan with their warplanes and naval ships. And this has become almost a daily matter. And if you know the sort of security situations of Taiwan, you know that mainland China is several times much bigger than us. And they spend a lot more on defense than Taiwan. So because of this disparity of military forces in the Taiwan Strait, and Taiwan holds a very important point in the shipping lanes, and also produce a lot of important high-end advanced chips for the world. So the security and safety of the Taiwan Strait has become almost a global issue now. A lot of governments, including that of the United States, are expressing concerns over the peace and stability in our area. So I think being in the center of these tensions, I think Taiwan has a duty and a responsibility to play a cautious role in making sure that the global trade and supply chains are not affected because of the situation in the Taiwan Strait.
Victor, Beijing makes no secret of the idea that it seems to prefer KMT rule to DPP rule. And in fact, before these particular exercises you just talked about, Joint Sword 2024B, kicked off, there was a video released by the Central Military Commission that said, among other things, that the purpose of the exercise was, quote, to deter separatist elements or extremists in Taiwan. And of course, they've referred to President Lai in those terms. So to what extent is the KMT's approach to relations with Beijing a difference in style versus are there actual substantive policy differences in how the KMT would deal with Beijing?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, we have no control over their positions vis-a-vis Taiwan, especially in terms of our presidential elections. But I would say that sometimes their expressions are not helpful in terms of our domestic politics. Many times when China tried to intervene into our politics, it's actually helping the DPP win more seats. So although we have a continuous dialogue with party-to-party dialogue with the Communist Party, but we always advise them not to interfere into our domestic politics because Taiwan, as they know, is operating on a very different political system. We have an open and free democracy. So we have to let the people the liberty and the space to exercise their democracy, democratic rights. Having said that, to be totally honest, we actually are the party that is most anti-communist for decades. Remember, after World War II, there was a civil war between the nationalist government and the communist government on the mainland, and we lost millions of comrades in that civil war. And after the government retreated to Taiwan in 1949, we exercised a three-no policy, that is, no contact, no compromise, no negotiation between the two sides. This only changed after the United States and most of the Western democracies offered Beijing diplomatic recognition. So about 9 years after the U.S. switched diplomatic recognition to Beijing, we felt we were unable to cope with the increasingly changing world. So in 1987, we relaxed our restrictions against our contacts with China. And since then, because our party stick to the One China Constitution, in that sense, we are a Chinese nation, but we exercise freedom and democracy. So we are Republic of China, used to be called Free China. And mainland China is Red China, Communist China. Although in, I would say, past 20 years, the political landscape in Taiwan has transformed quite a bit. A lot of young people don't fully understand the complex history between the two sides of Taiwan Straits. So they recognize Taiwan as a separate identity. And I have to admit that presents a tremendous challenge to my political party in winning the young voters' support. But having said that, I think upholding the Constitution of the Republic of China still serves as a political foundation for two sides of the Taiwan Strait to continue this sort of a functional dialogue that can reduce the risk of miscalculation and also can cultivate mutual understandings and promote trade and people-to-people exchange. In that regard, I think in the long run, it's in everybody's interest. Because remember in the past few decades, the Communist China has been telling the world that Western style of democracy doesn't work in a traditional Chinese society. But when you look at Taiwan, same cultural background, but democracy can flourish in a short period of time. So that proves the existence of Taiwan as a democracy can be a model for the Chinese people in the future. So in that regard, I think maintaining the dialogue and the relationship and reduce the tensions is still in everybody's interest. That's why my party is still opposes to Taiwan independence.
I just do want to get back to this. So substantively, can you tell me the specific policy differences between the DPP and the KMT vis-a-vis China?
All right. First of all, we uphold the constitution. So we still support the 1992 consensus, which means we believe there's only one China, but with different interpretations. So to us, it's the Republic of China. To mainland China, it's the People's Republic of China. But the ruling party, the DPP's view is that there are two countries on both sides of Taiwan Strait. So whether we are called the Republic of China or Taiwan, we are a separate country than the PRC. So in that sense, it's an advocacy for Taiwan independence, legal independence, and that is a departure from our constitution. The other side of the coin is that we want to have a functional communications, line of communications with Beijing for a lot of reasons. To start with, we have over 1 million Taiwanese people left and operate within mainland China. And they need a government that can protect their rights when there's a dispute. Because of the current government's position on Taiwan independence and the status of Taiwan, so they haven't had any kind of official communication with Beijing since 2006. While at the same time, the tensions in the Taiwan Strait continue to rise. So in that regard, we are very different from the ruling party's position. That is, we want to have a communication with mainland China. Although we don't agree with them on a lot of things, we criticize their human rights abuses and violations. But at the same time, we want to have a workable dialogue that if there's a crisis, we can really sit down and talk. So in a way to avoid any physical conflict.
Right. So my understanding is that the DPP has not been explicit about having a separate entity as Taiwan, but they have had aspects of the party who've indicated they want to go in that direction. They've reached out to the Chinese government in Beijing about dialogue, and they've been rebuffed. So it's clear that because KMT is so clear about one China, that's the preferred party, despite, to people like me, it's the remarkable historical enmity between Kuomintang and CCP is incredible. But I guess then the question is, how does the KMT manage Xi's constant statements that reunification of Taiwan with the mainland is his overriding necessity? What does reunification mean to the CCP from your dialogue, and what does it mean to KMT?
That's a very perfect, very good question. Unification. Remember our last KMT president, Ma Ying-jeou, the first few days after his inauguration, he mentioned that on the cross-strait relations, he had three no policies: no unification, no war, no independence. So, although our constitution supports a one China concept, but that doesn't mean that the KMT is supporting unification anytime soon. I think over the past decades, we offer several solutions for cross-strait relations. Some may say that we can use the three principles of the people, in other words, the model of Taiwan, to unify China. So I think the perception is very important. Perception is very important. I know that DPP doesn't intentionally or willfully try to rock the boat and sort of turn Taiwan into a turmoil in a conflict with China. But nonetheless, the perception of Beijing about DPP is that this is a party that has a long history of advocacy for Taiwan independence. In other words, permanent separation from China. And as a country not exercising a democracy, and the existence of their political party relies on the national integrity and territorial sovereignty, it would be very hard for the CCP not to react to the position of Taiwan independence. Otherwise, their party would run the risk of being overthrown. Having said that, I would say that by advocating to our constitution and not saying that we are and saying that the unification is a remote possibility, that can give us time to prepare ourselves for any future eventualities. I mean, we're talking about tensions in the strait. And right now, the United States is helping Taiwan to strengthen its defense capabilities. But we have to be very honest, we are not ready. Militarily, psychologically, even economically. So we need valuable time to better prepare ourselves. And I believe the KMT's position to maintain the dialogue, not prematurely provoke CCP or unnecessarily provoke CCP, would buy us time in this preparation.
So thank you, Victor. with this time, what would the KMT do to prepare Taiwan to either deter or resist a PRC attempt to reunify the country by force? Would it increase defense spending? Would it, how would it prepare the nation? Would it increase the Taiwan's network of partnerships on the military side? What would the KMT do with this time that it seeks?
Okay, this is a very important question, actually. That's also makes it different, differs of my party to the ruling party. We have a 2D strategy. First D is defense. The way we see the situation, how we should prepare ourselves, is not just on the military front. That's exactly what the DPP has been doing in the past few years. Yes, they are gradually increased defense spending. They are buying more weapon systems from the United States. They are extending the compulsory service of our young men. All these are in the right direction, but it is not enough. I tell you why. Because countries like the United States, or even Ukraine, they all have this national strategic security, a national security strategy that would incorporate everybody into this preparation. So the defense is not just the responsibility of the Ministry of National Defense. It's actually the responsibility of the entire government and also our people. I can give you a very simple example. In the past few years, we have this air raid drills all over Taiwan. But the things that in the very beginning, people just do things as they used to. Only the designated areas are exercising these air drills seriously, not the rest of the country. And when the Chinese POS missiles flew over our skies, most people in Taiwan just conduct their daily lives as nothing has happened. I mean, there's something wrong there, right? In terms of preparation, I think everybody has to involve. Now people are talking about gray zone area, gray zone threat. I can give you an example. Because Taiwan is heavily dependent on imported energy resources. To put it very simply, we rely on the LNG shipment every 5 days or so for major power generation. In a situation like a blockade, our energy supply would become a serious problem. But a lot of people don't know that the POA doesn't have to have a full-scale blockade. All they have to do is to stop 3 to 4 shipments of LNG vessels in South China Sea, where they have the capabilities to do so. Then Taiwan would run out of electricity. So how can we defend ourselves when there's no power? All right? So...
And sorry, so what is the KMT's response to your own question? What would the KMT do to address that vulnerability for LNG?
Okay. We support the continuation of nuclear power. We drew the lessons from the war in Ukraine. The reason why Ukraine has managed to fight on until now is not just because of the Western generous support, but also because Ukraine has nuclear power that can provide their basic necessities, everyday necessity, and also support their military operations. If there's a blackout in Taiwan, then our military will find it very hard to operate. Another thing is that our national security strategy would accept the coordination, a mechanism for each government agencies to work together. And as you know, I think you're in the military before, in order to run a successful military operation, you need a lot of exercises and drills. Without real exercises and drills, when the situation comes, I don't think people or even any government agency will be ready. So our national security strategy put everybody into this coordinated mechanism that we can exercise in a peacetime. So when the time comes, everybody know exactly how to do, how to behave.
So, you know, the U.S. is supplying increased military assistance to Taiwan. The government of Beijing heavily criticizes that activity. There are some people from the U.S. military who help train Taiwan on the use of some of these weapon systems. That activity is heavily criticized in Beijing. And even when one of our politicians stops for a visit or one of your politicians stops in the U.S., that is heavily criticized. So anything that smacks of a more robust Taiwan defense could trigger the very activity which the KMT is trying to avoid, no?
Mainland China has been doing that over several decades. I remember after President Reagan signed a joint communique with the PRC, the U.S. promised to reduce arms sales scales to Taiwan. But look at recent years. China has altered its commitment. It changed its commitment to use a peaceful means vis-a-vis relations with Taiwan. They're not only spending a lot more on their defense, on their military capabilities, and they're also crossing the median line in the Taiwan Strait and coming to our eastern side. So this is a new situation. In order to cope with it, we certainly would need more support from the United States and from other countries around the world. And in our dialogue with Beijing, we are also advising them that what's the purpose of those military exercises? And of course, politicians from around the world, especially from the parliaments, from the Congress, should have the right to visit Taiwan to show that the people's support of democracy and freedom. So why? And their opposition to it is actually serve a counter purpose.
So what does Beijing tell you when you say your exercises are actually, you know, why are you doing it? What's the purpose? What is their response?
Their response is always saying that, well, this is not targeted at the peace-loving Taiwan people. It's only targeted at, how should I say, independence advocates, you know, mainly the DPP government. But, you know, you're threatening everybody. How can you differentiate, you know, the government and the people? And also, especially when it disrupts regular commercial trafficking, you know, the shipment.
Well, I think
everybody's affected.
Victor, that leads us into a really interesting question, which is, to what extent do you believe that Beijing's messaging about independence extremists or those kinds of things is genuine? You know, they're genuinely opposed to either the DPP or President Lai or these unnamed extremists. And to what extent are they just using it as a pretext to do what they want to do anyway, which is tighten their grip on Taiwan so that ultimately, in their view, they can coerce Taiwan into a capitulation sometime in the future? Are they doing it because they really worry that Taiwan is going to try to declare independence? Or are they doing it as a pretext to do other things they want to do anyway? Or is it just both?
Well, we have no illusions about their long-term goals with regard to Taiwan. They certainly want to annex Taiwan and unify the entire country. This is their mission. This hasn't changed since Mao Zedong took over mainland China. But having said that, we should have a certain level of confidence in the way that, remember, one of the conditions for the PRC to establish diplomatic relations with the United States is that they promised to use peaceful means to achieve unification. All right? While they are using those peaceful means, they are also affected by the exchange and interaction with Taiwan. I remember this was probably before 2006, before the DPP took power again, that every year we welcome more than 4 million to 8 million mainland Chinese tourists to Taiwan. The first thing they would want to do is to watch political talk shows in Taiwan, where our commentators can criticize the government, the president directly. And they found it very exciting. So after a week's visit, when they go back to China, they're going to tell their friends and relatives about the thing that they see in Taiwan. Of course, right now, I don't think the situation is ripe for a change of the CCP or form a new political party that would challenge the dominance of CCP. But taken the experience from Taiwan and many other developing democracies, this is the beginning of the burgeoning of the ideas of democracy. So why don't we keep this sort of a peaceful means as long as possible, as long as it takes? Then maybe in the future, it is the West, the democracy that unifies the whole of China, not the other way around.
Oh, but, so, but do you think Xi and his people is patient?
It's a very positive thing to think. But everybody have to have a hope in order to survive. And to provoke China when the situation is not right, it's going to disrupt everything that we have been making an effort towards. And in the end, it won't help. It's not in our interest. It's not in our best interest.
Do you think current U.S. policy towards Taiwan is correct?
Well, there's a campaign season. So during this election campaign, we hear a lot of different things.
Yes, you
from
do.
Those camps.
Honestly, we wish that there would be more discussion about Taiwan during our campaign, because it seems to have been a fairly substance-free campaign with regards to that, in our opinion.
But we've been watching the U.S. politics for many, many decades. So we are mature enough to know that some of them are just political talks. Once they're in the government, they're not going to implement the thing they say 100%. And there's still room for communication and negotiations. But one thing is very clear, that if we cannot keep the tensions in Taiwan Straits in check, then there will be increasing pressure, not just from the United States, but also from other neighboring countries, of how we prepare ourselves, especially on the defense aspect. And as you know, we are a democracy. We cannot increase the defense budget overnight by 100% or 200%. Where does the money come from? So we need to really have to strike a balance in our approach to the situation right now. And so the 2D strategy, as I mentioned, on the one hand side, we have to increase our defense preparedness. But on the other hand, we have to maintain the dialogue with Beijing.
So I'm going to take this opportunity kind of to insert myself into the discussion. Since my last trip to Taiwan, I appeared at an event in which I advocated for more transparency into a lot of China's gray zone activities around Taiwan as a way of building national resilience and the people of Taiwan and international support for Taiwan and sort of recognition of the threat to Taiwan. And I sort of used the Philippines experience in illuminating gray zone activities. What would be your view of this kind of transparency campaign? Would you view it as being provocative, or do you think it would be helpful in doing the things that I talked about?
I think it's very helpful, as I mentioned, because now the sort of, how do you call that? Cognitive warfare or something like that. It's very sophisticated. They're using a lot of software to penetrate into the targeted audience. Although for the government officials and also the intellectuals, they have the wisdom to tell the difference. But I have to admit that some of the ordinary folks, they don't have the luxury or time to have a deep study of those information, sometimes would be misled. So I think the government and the people should form a coordinated effort, making sure that all the information they receive has a fact check and the people's information is correct. Because without correct information, we cannot make a wise decision or a judgment. So I fully support.
So one aspect of Taiwan policy now is actually based on Ukraine and U.S. policy towards Ukraine. So one group thinks we have to defend Ukraine because if that falls, it calls into question whether West would come to the aid of Taiwan and other countries. The other group says, actually, we have to let Ukraine go to be a European problem and put all our resources into defending Taiwan and containing China. So do you have an opinion on either of those views?
I think each side has its own merits. I'm not here to judge which one is more correct. But I would say that, of course, if you let the aggressor to take whatever it wants too easily, then certainly it would serve as a bad example for other potential aggressors to follow suit. But having said that, I would still think that the defense is mainly our own responsibility. No country can rely its own defense on other countries. So we have to bear the bulk of our responsibilities as a country under threat from communist China. That's why I have to resort to the 2D strategy that I mentioned, that you have to have a balanced approach in order to reduce the make the threat minimum, but also maximize the time to prepare for yourselves.
Victor, I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity to kind of get your view on something that is pretty remarkable in Taiwan politics recently, which is this rise of a third party. Why is this happening, and what is its effect on Taiwan politics and on the KMT specifically?
If you ask a friend of the TPP, probably they will say, I'm not the perfect guy to answer this question. But, you know, before this position, I was in the Foreign Service for a long time. So I worked under different governments for a long period of time. I would say this. Simply put, a lot of people in Taiwan, especially among young people, they are frustrated with both political parties, not just KMT, but also the DPP, because they promise a lot of things, but deliver way too little. But I have to say that the third political force is not a new phenomenon in Taiwan. In the past, what happened was usually there was a split from the KMT. You saw that in many previous presidential elections. And whenever there was a split, my party is the one who's to suffer. So we lost. This time, DPP, although not a split in theory, but it did take a lot of votes out of the KMT's camp. So in a way, we also suffered because of this third political party. But having said that, one development recently is very worrisome because, as you know, Coinger, the candidate for president of TPP, is now under arrest, being detained almost 2 months. And if you read the news release by TPP, you can say that they are saying that the prosecution or the detainment is politically motivated, and it's a political witch hunt using the weaponized the judicial system. I'm not here to pass any judgment on that, but I would say that this, right after presidential elections, within, I would say, months, you put a major candidate that won almost 30% of the vote under arrest. That does sort of arise a lot of questions, especially after 2 months' detention. There's no charge brought against him. And while there's a lot of speculations in the news media, a lot of them are apparently fed by sort of a vicious a person aiming at defame the TPP and it's the way you operate. I hope the judiciary can process this case much faster because they have all the means, tools that they need. And to keep this sort of lingering on is not very helpful to the consolidation of our democracy. If you ask people in the streets, I would say that at least one third of the respondents have questions about how Cohen's case has been handled. And this is not good. This also erodes people's confidence in our judiciary. And let's hope it can be resolved very quickly.
Well, thank goodness we don't have problems like this, that in this country. The one thing that unites Washington, it seems, is China policy. Everyone seems to agree that the U.S. has to get tougher on China. At least one candidate's talking about raising tariffs significantly. Is this helpful to Taiwan or not?
Well, I think the year before last year, the biggest debate is whether there should be a strategic ambiguity or strategic clarity. Now the debate has turned to whether the United States should have an end stage, a strategy towards policy on China. I think it's a very healthy situation that people with different experience and different ideas can offer their suggestions. And how this debate is going to evolve and who is going to gain the upper hand is to everybody's guess. But I would say that at least in these discussions and debates, one thing is very clear. That is, there is more and more people realize the threat from the rise of China. And we have been advising the U.S. since the 70s and 80s about the policies, the engagement policy towards China, saying that, you know, if you just engage with China, make China rich, and then you have no control of their policies, domestic policies, then what's what you worry is happening right now. They use the money that they earn from trading with the rest of the world to build up their military, to control its people, to use the advanced software monitoring surveillance of their people. And no, Xi Jinping is a leader who has a big dream for China. But sometimes in order to achieve this dream, it has to take a reverse sort of a direction of all the openness and policy, the modernization programs set forth by its predecessors. And that's why people are worrying right now. And I think the debate is very healthy because it makes a lot of people realize the situation and are willing to play a role in safeguarding the rule-based international order.
Well, as Winston Churchill said, America will always do the right thing after it has tried everything else. So, Victor Chin, we do thank you for joining us today. And if people are interested in you or what the Kuomintang is, and especially if they don't speak Mandarin, as many of our listeners don't, although we do have listeners around the world, where should people go to learn more?
Well, at the KMT headquarters, we have Instagram and YouTube and also, what's the others called? We have several accounts that you can follow. Then you'll get the almost daily updates of all the activities and the policy paper we churn out. And usually it's a very short and simple and concise form, so easier to digest. I hope that these will be very useful.
All right.
But also, feel free to contact me if I can be of service.
Well, you're very kind with your time to have joined us this morning. It's been really illuminating and informative for us, and we want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you, Jim, for your concern over Taiwan. I hope this conversation can continue. Thank you.
Well, Ray, that was an interesting discussion since we've talked about Taiwan a lot. Now we get sort of from a horse's mouth.
Yep.
What'd you make of all that?
Well, so the KMT is actually a really interesting case. You know, again, they are the out party, but they're also the old party. They're the original party. And you know, as Victor said, that they are sort of the original anti-communists of Taiwan. But today, they're seen as more of the China party or the Beijing-friendly party, and they don't run away from that, although they shy away from it for sure, right? So they have these party-to-party talks with the Communist Party to China, and they advertise that. They say that's a good thing because somebody has to talk to China, and I can see the argument for that. And yet, you know, there's also kind of a very skeptical view, and I think I mean, there's part of me that really sort of shares this, which is, you know, if Beijing likes your party better than the other party, that should raise some red flags. You know, they see a future for themselves, and of course their objectives, as Victor very much admitted, are not in Taiwan's, in democratic Taiwan's favor. They, you know, their objectives are to absorb Taiwan. And again, Victor acknowledges this. He just believes that Taiwan needs time, and the way to get time is to sort of push the brakes a bit on sort of what Beijing would call the separatist, you know, the extremists, but just to sort of stabilize relations with Beijing.
Well, the overlap in interest between the KMT and the CCP is they both agree there's only one China.
Yeah.
And to me, that is what Beijing likes about the KMT. Now, the fact that KMT still has, and Victor sort of alluded to it, this idea that with enough time that democratization will become more popular in Beijing, it could be true, but I'm not going to bet the mortgage on that one. I think much more likely is if things start to go look that way, that would launch some sort of action from Beijing to make sure they're the absorbee, absorber, not the absorbee.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, nobody really, you can't name somebody out there who has a serious theory of victory for Taiwan that includes absorbing, you know, communist China at this point. You know, maybe in almost in a science fiction realm, you know, where you see that as a possible future or a very long term view. And I think, I guess Victor alluded to this a little bit, basically talking about, you know, the fact that there are more and more people in China who have seen what democracy does. But I think that sort of ignores the fact that in Xi Jinping's China, the control of information is more total than it was before. And the trickle of people who go abroad and come back is nothing compared to the overwhelming control that Beijing has over the rest of the 1.4 billion people who live there.
Right. No, the giant question, we've discussed this many times before in our podcast, is Xi seems very serious about achieving the China dream of reunification. And whether it's the 2027 timeline or whatever, it's within his lifetime, and he's what, 70-something?
Yeah.
So, and Victor's response is, yeah, we need to build up our defense, but we have budget restrictions.
Yes, and... You know, I mean, and that's real, right? And so this actually gets back to kind of a conversation that we've been having for a while. I had as recently as a couple of days ago with somebody, which is the fact that despite the fact that everybody looks at this huge issue coming at us, which is a potential, a non-zero chance or a substantial chance that China will try to reunify Taiwan by force, there is almost no conversation about that in our political system. And so, you know, really, let's say the chances are 10%, that such an attempt will be made, say, in the next 4 years during the next presidency. A 10% chance of a major theater war against a nuclear power should be enough to freak everybody out, right? Now, 10%, when you look at it, you know, sort of overall, that doesn't seem to undersell it. I mean, that doesn't seem to oversell it. That may undersell it, if anything. And so, you know, it really should be something that we're spending a lot more time on. And frankly, and this was my question at an event yesterday, Why is there no plank on anybody's platform here in the U.S. election, the topic of rebuilding America's defense capabilities to meet this rising challenge, you know, to ultimately to deter China? Shouldn't that be a major discussion point? Shouldn't it have come in up in maybe one presidential or vice presidential debate, maybe just one?
Well, both parties say they're the ones who are spending on defense. And yeah, get into nitty gritty, Ray. I don't know what you're thinking.
Yes. Well, okay. So let's turn from that sort of, you know, frivolous topic to something much more important, which is what is your story for our listeners today? Tell me a There I Was story.
There I Was. Okay, I'm going to change from what I originally thought to something else, given that we're a week away from the elections.
Oh.
As a kid, I spent a lot of time going to school and living in Greece because my father was a Greek American, had businesses both places. And in 1967, there was a military coup in Greece that overthrew the democratically elected government. Now, what's interesting about that, of course, is you may have heard that Athens invented democracy. They are inordinately proud of something that happened more than 2,000 years ago. And yet, a few military colonels, you're a colonel, right? Military colonels overthrew the government. No shots were fired. King went to exile, rest of the politicians. And there was barely a boo as democracy fell and the dictatorship ensued. Now, why was that? Well, government was seen as being corrupt, ineffective, loud. There used to be fistfights in parliament on a fairly regular basis. And you could see the people said, well, at least the colonels will be honest and government will be more efficient. Mm-hmm. And as we go to the polls now and think about all the problems with our government,
yep.
Let's remember that promises of authoritarians or a more strict government delivering may work short term, but in every case, that same government somehow becomes corrupt and difficult for them to hear criticism.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to commit the sin of quoting Winston Churchill a second time in a single podcast. Which is that democracy is the worst form of government, except for everything else that's been tried. And, you know, I actually sort of quote that quite a bit in my travels. And in fact, I expect to be in a foreign capital next week, perhaps on a television show talking about the American elections. And people have lots of questions about how we do things and why we do the Electoral College, you know, why we do things the way we do. And democracy is fundamentally messy. I mean, and everybody who has a ideological or political agenda wishes it could be simpler to do the things that we want done. And yet our founders actually developed a system to make it as hard as possible to do those things, not as hard as possible, but difficult to do those things because it wanted to avoid, well, it wanted to avoid tyranny, of course, but it also wanted to avoid sort of us lurching back and forth from one agenda to the next so that, you know, each imperial presidency could impose their will. And then the next one would come in and put all their enemies in jail and impose their will and all of those things. So, you know, the whole checks and balances thing is great if you're in the opposition and you hate it if your party takes control. And now all of a sudden the checks and balances are evil, or the Electoral College is evil, or that whatever it is that stands in your way is evil. And, you know, I would remind my fellow Americans, and of course, and just anyone who exists in the context of a democratic government, that these things are a feature, not a bug. The alternative is, you know, across the Taiwan Strait, as it were. Xi Jinping's government is very efficient when it decides to do a particular thing. And it can do that thing extremely quickly, extremely well, with a lot of resources if it decides it wants to do it. And what we believe as people who live in democracies is it's better for the country long term. It's better for the people of the country long term if you don't let one person have the power that we tend to want our particular party to have whenever they're in power.
Thus endeth the sermon.
Amen. And so our usher today is Ian Ellis Jones, who produces high quality military and geopolitical hymns on X. You can follow Brother Jones at Ian Ellis Jones. If you enjoyed this sermon, please make sure you check out and subscribe to all of our other sermons at youtube.com at IP Podcasts. You'll meet with our other congregants, such as Admiral Phil Davidson in episode 14, where we talked about why should we care about Taiwan's Davidson window vis-a-vis 2027. And of course, we talked a little bit about why should we care about America's defense priorities. That was episode 11 with Elbridge Colby. You can also turn in your hymnal to social media pages on LinkedIn and X. And of course, if you like audio podcasts like I do, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, all of those, we are on them all. Thank you for joining us for today's service. And we'll meet again next Sunday at Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?
God willing.
God willing. The creek don't rise.